You are now listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast, where the worlds of sports medicine and performance collide. My name is Mike Quintons. I'm a physical therapist with an entrepreneurial mindset that specializes in treating orthopedic and sports injuries. I'm bringing on the brightest and sharpest in the field of sports medicine to share their best practices and explore the gap where medicine meets performance. Welcome to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. This is Mike Quintons, your host. Today, we are joined by Dr. Cohen, who is a board-certified sports medicine surgeon. He is the head physician and medical director for the Philadelphia Phillies. His other roles include orthopedic consultant for Immaculata and Newman Universities, in addition to Pancras, Lower Marion, Sacred Heart, and Community Academy of Philadelphia High Schools. Dr. Stephen Cohen served as a medical director for the Philadelphia Marathon for 10 years. He currently serves on the medical advisory board for Major League Baseball and was the recent president of Major League Baseball Team Physician Association. He's a professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at Thomas Jefferson University and is the co-director of sports medicine research at Rothman Orthopedic Institute. He has published and presented research extensively, both nationally and internationally, and has been an editor of 8 medicine books. In 2009, Dr. Cohen was named as a rising star by Philadelphia Magazine. Dr. Cohen is a native of Cherry Hill, New Jersey, where he is a member of the top 5 nationally ranked state championship Cherry Hill West baseball teams and went on to play collegiate baseball at Columbia University. He received his medical degree from UMDNJ, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, and completed his orthopedic residency at the University of Virginia. He followed with sports medicine fellowship at the University Pitt Medical Center, during which he worked closely with the Pittsburgh Steelers, Penguins, and the University of Pittsburgh athletic program. Welcome to the podcast, Doc.
Thank you very much, Mike. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is we're really excited about this. I'm also joined with Robert Bina here, Director of Strength Conditioning at Ivy Rehab in Newtown Square. So let's get into this. A little bit of like a background question. How did you get into orthopedic surgery and why?
Well, I think it was just a matter of being interested in medicine from a young age, and probably as early as age 10, I knew I wanted to be a physician. Around age 12, I was visiting my uncle, who's a family medicine doctor in Maine. He thought it would be a good idea for me to spend some time with an orthopedic surgeon in a community setting, followed him around for a few days, and that was pretty much it. So the combination of being an athlete, playing sports growing up, wanting to be involved with medicine kind of led me to orthopedics.
That's awesome. And so what about that experience brought you closer to orthopedics? Like, how did you go that route as you played baseball at Columbia and so forth? Did you know at that point in time you're getting an orthopedic surgeon?
Orthopedics, it's very much a fix-it type of practice. You know, you have people that come in who are injured. You want to get them back to perform, and orthopedics is a really great way to do that. Sports is obviously one field within orthopedics. There's, you know, so many other ones that do great work. But for me, it just was a great fit, something that I really wanted to be involved in. And I think if you have that passion and that desire, then it's a really good fit.
All right, so let's dive into the UCL. So the mechanism of injury for, you know, a tear, how does that happen?
So the UCL is predominantly responsible for valgus stress. So for, you know, the non-physicians out there listening, you know, that's stress of the hand going away from the body. So the throwing motion, a tennis serve, throwing a javelin, hitting a volleyball, all these things require the UCL. If you're a gymnast and you're doing a lot of work, you know, off of your hands, handsprings, things like that, require valgus stress. So you need stability of that. Well, the problem with the UCL is if you throw a baseball hard enough, that actually is more force than the UCL can take on one given moment. Now, if that was the case, then the UCL would tear on every throw, and somebody like Jose Alvarado, who throws the ball 101 miles an hour, would never have a UCL at work. So there's more than just the UCL at play here, but valgus stress, high velocity throwing, traumatic injuries, that's what injures the UCL.
How often are you seeing that there are other factors involved, whether it's shoulder, neck, back? You know, obviously that's part of the chain, right? So from my perspective, at least as a PT, I want to identify, you know, how did this happen?
Yeah, so the term we use obviously is the kinetic chain, which means that in order to throw a baseball, it starts from your big toe all the way up to your fingers, then when the ball leaves your hand. So that whole chain goes from the bottom all the way up to the top. So if you have any break in the link in the chain, whether that's a problem with your hips, a problem with your core, problem with your shoulder, elbow, hand, wrist, all those things play factors in it. The biggest thing for us, obviously, is the shoulder. And I can't tell you how many occasions, you know, a young athlete will come in, they come in with elbow pain, and I'm about to examine them. I ask them to remove their shirt, and they look at me like I'm crazy. Because the first thing I'm going to do is examine their shoulder, their scapula, to make sure there's no issues with that. Because typically, There are. And if you don't take their shirt off, and if you don't look at them, and if it's a female, you get them into a gown and all different ways to do that. But you have to be able to see the shoulder and the scapula. And if you don't, then you're not doing a thorough exam, and you could miss things that, you know, if they have a partial injury or they have just some elbow pain and you correct the shoulder, you oftentimes fix the elbow as well. So the kinetic chain is a huge focus in what we do.
And the research supports that, you know, that addressing the, you know, thoracic spine, shoulder will help to address elbow pain and other things than just these types of injuries and tennis elbow as well. So how's this diagnosed? How's a UCL tear typically diagnosed?
So, you know, obviously the history is the biggest thing. So, you know, as a physician, you always start with the history. Listen to your patient. They tell you what's happening. When does it hurt them to throw? Where does it hurt them to throw? If they're having pain in the lateral side of their elbow, it's not a UCL. Now, caveat to that is you can get some compression to the outside part of the elbow if you have some ligamentous laxity of the UCL. But overall, they're going to hurt on the medial side of their elbow. So they're going to point to that. When do they hurt? Does it hurt, you know, when they're in the layback position? So if you played baseball or take care of baseball athletes, you know, everybody knows the diagram. So the old term was late cocking, early acceleration phase of throwing. So when their arm's back, you know, as far back in external rotation. Well, but if you ask a player, when does your elbow hurt them? They're not going to say my elbow hurts in the late cocking and early acceleration phase of throwing. That just doesn't happen. Well, when it hurts them is when they're in the layback position, and they'll demonstrate it. And if you have the terminology on board, then you can get on the same page with them. If you don't, then you may not figure out when it is. So it could also have pain on ball release. Now, if they have pain on ball release, that typically is more common with posterior elbow symptoms. So valgus extension overload or posterior impingement. They could have an olecranon stress fracture, olecranon osteophytes. So there's any number of things, but where does it hurt them? When does it hurt them? How long has it been going on? Those are all important things. Now, there's three main structures on the medial side of the elbow. There's the ligament, there's the nerve, and then there's the tendons. So the flexor pronator allows you to release the ball and with your wrist in flexion and pronate. That's how you throw a fastball. So the flexor pronator can be involved. Are they having any numbness or tingling? Do they have any radiating symptoms? Do the fingers go numb? Do they feel like it goes dead? So just like the medial side of the knee can affect their certain structures, the same thing with the elbow. So you have to cone down on what the symptoms are. When does it happen? So that's the first part. That's the history. The second part, obviously, is the physical exam. So they should hurt along their ulnar collateral ligament. Now, again, there's always caveats to everything that we say, because if somebody tore their UCL and they have a complete tear and it happened 3 or 4 weeks ago, they're actually not likely to have pain along the medial side of their elbow 3 or 4 weeks after an injury, because it's kind of calmed down, it's resolved. And then even when you valgus stress them, and that's part of the exam, they may gap open and it may not hurt them that much because the ligament's actually torn. The ones that hurt are the partial tears, because their ligament's still intact, but you're stretching the ligament and evaluating that. So you're going to evaluate the range of motion, you're going to evaluate the strength, you're going to assess the nerve, assess them in what we call the valgus stress position, so the milking maneuver, there's a dynamic valgus stress test, all different ways to do these tests. You kind of have to find the way that's best for you. And I will tell you that you're looking for medial gapping. Now, the abnormal amount of valgus stress or valgus gapping is about 2 millimeters. So what I tell most people, whether they're my fellows or athletic trainers I'm working with, and I have an incredible athletic trainer I work with in the Phillies who's been doing this for 20 years, I tell him, do you really think you can assess 2 millimeters of valgus gapping on a physical exam? It's not easy to do.
Right.
So to tell somebody that, oh, I can feel you stress, that's 2 millimeters. That's a difficult thing. So, you know, on top of that is imaging. So MRI or MRI arthrogram. In Philadelphia, we use a ton of dynamic stress ultrasound that we can assess joint space under stress moving, and we can assess it at rest and at stress, and that gives us a really good number. We've been doing this for minor league pitchers since 2002, and we've got data in minor league pitchers for the last over 20 years.
And what's some of the results of that?
Well, you're essentially evaluating healthy pitchers. So what we're doing is trying to assess what does their joint space look like under stress when they're, quote, healthy. Right. Now, we can assess them under and assess what their risk factors are. So somebody who has 2 millimeters of gapping and they're healthy, that may be normal for them.
Right.
But it's also typically abnormal. So that may be somebody that we keep a closer eye on. And then we have an idea, okay, well, if you start developing symptoms, then we have a better sense of that and we can keep a closer eye on them.
Right. So just for comparison, what is, you know, the normal gapping for ACL for the knee?
So less than 5 millimeters is what you would assess for an ACL. So that's a normal. If you look at KT 2000 studies, about 2 to 3 millimeters is essentially what you would see side to side.
Right.
About the same. Greater than 5 millimeters becomes abnormal.
Right. Yeah, that's what I remember in school. We don't KT. They is that what they use on cadavers during these some of these studies for internal bracing and so forth? Like, how are they testing the amount of force that the ligament can take during bracing?
So we use a telos device, which is a device that can measure the amount of valgus stress. We've been doing this again since 2007 with the telos device, and so we can put a reproducible amount of stress on every single player. That's 15 newtons of stress on their elbow, and then we can go every one of our pitchers, and we know, okay, it's pretty symmetric.
Right. So a lot has changed with respect to the surgical techniques and approaches over the past several years. How is a torn or compromised UCL treated surgically?
So obviously it depends on the status of the UCL, whether it's an acute or chronic issue, whether it's a young or an older player, what their goals are, what are they trying to get back to. So if you have a high school player and they have a traumatic one episode, they have a tear from one side of the ligament, so the top or the bottom, so the proximal or the distal end of the ligament, and it's a relatively healthy ligament, that may be a candidate for a primary repair. You can suture the torn ligament back to its insertion. You can put an augmented internal brace with collagen-coated tape on top of it, and the results have been very, very good. So Jeff Dugas developed this technique. Buddy Savoie published data on doing a primary repair in 2007 and actually had fairly good results in certain indicated procedures. Now, Frank Job tried to do this. A number of other surgeons tried to do this in the 80s and 90s and failed, didn't get a lot of athletes back. I think it was more the indications than it was the actual procedure. So when Dr. Savoie published the data, very specific, single-sided injury, relatively healthy ligament, and then Jeff kind of piggybacked on top of that and added the internal brace. And what we found is that somewhere in the neighborhood of about 92% of athletes can get back to throwing at a relatively shorter period. So it's just under 7 months if you can do a primary repair. So if you're a high school athlete and your sole goal is to get back to high school baseball, a reconstruction, which we'll get to, I'm sure, in a second, is going to take 12, 14, 16 months. Most high school athletes don't have that time. So if you can do a primary repair, you have a better chance of getting that athlete back to playing high school baseball. Now, again, if they are an elite level player, they're going to go on to college, they may sign a professional contract, depending on, again, the status of the ligament. And if they have a mid-substance tear, not a candidate for a repair. Partial tears, again, that are one-sided, those are candidates to consider a primary repair. So you have to have a healthy ligament, relatively healthy ligament. You have to have a one-sided injury. You have to want to consider the timing of getting back sooner. And if those all work out, that is a reasonable option for somebody.
I was reading up on this, and I'd heard, this makes perfect sense to me, that a lot of the procedures that were done back in, like you said, the 80s, 90s, Job was doing them, those tears were happening in a much older, for the most part, an older population. Is that fair to say? And therefore, perhaps the integrity of the ligament, very different than what you would see in, you know, what we're seeing now, with 16, 15, 14-year-olds.
Yeah, so I think that's a good characterization of likely what you were seeing back then. You know, the largest growing population of UCL tears at the age group is 15 to 19.
Yeah. And before, likely that it was probably
before it was about
in the league for a long time.
Yeah, before it was about 22 to 26.
Okay, yeah. So the integrity of the ligament would be different. Okay.
And a lot of it depends on, you know, what this athlete's been through. So, you know, we take care of a lot of Latin players, Venezuela, Dominican, Cuba, Puerto Rico. These are kids that have been throwing a baseball for a long, long time. They play year round. Unfortunately, there's a lot of scenarios where the only way for them to get out of their country is to play baseball. So at 14, 15, they're elite level pitchers and they are throwing high velocity. They're throwing all the time. They're throwing year round. They're trying to get noticed, trying to get signed. And those are not generally the same ligaments that you see in 14 to 15 year olds in the Philadelphia area.
Right. That's fair. When you're about to do a procedure, how do you know which one you're going to do? Do you know in advance, or do you kind of, is the patient aware that we could do internal bracing, we could do TJ?
Yeah, any time you're going to think about doing a primary repair, you have to be prepared to do a reconstruction. Right. If for some reason the ligament, the quality isn't good enough, or it's just you're not happy with that situation, you have to be prepared for it. You know, obviously, for the most part, your plan going into it is based on your physical exam, the discussions you've had, and, you know, your imaging. So again, very unlikely you would plan to do a reconstruction and then do a repair. That would be unusual. The more likely scenario is you're planning on doing a repair, and it's just not what you see when you get in there, and you may have to go to a reconstruction.
So when you're doing a reconstruction, do you have a preference in what kind of graft you like to use?
Yeah, so the typically you're going to use a palmaris longus autograft, which is from the wrist. There's about maybe 18 to 20% of people that don't have a palmaris. So if you don't have it, then you have to go to another source, and that source is typically your hamstring. So we'll use a gracilis autograft. So the gracilis is one of your hamstring tendons. It's the smaller of the two main ones that we use for ACL reconstruction. So since it's a pretty common graft that we use, harvesting a gracilis isn't too difficult. And most people tolerate it pretty well. There's definitely some debate on which one do you use. Do you use the contralateral? Do you use the same side? You know, and it can vary from person to person. Do you want it to be on your lead leg? Do you want it to be on your plant leg? There's some debate about that. And the research doesn't show any real significant difference. I know if you're Neil Elitrotch in California using the same side, I'll use the opposite side.
Okay. All right. So here's one for you. Why the difference between the recovery time, right? So why the difference between DJ recovery time and primary recovery time?
Yeah. So obviously when you're doing a reconstruction, you're relying on healing of that graft. That graft has to be incorporated within the ligament, has to mature. It's a tendon. We're putting in a tendon and asking it to become a ligament and function as a ligament. So it's not ready to do that from time zero that we put it in. So it takes time. You have to build your strength back. You have to allow this graft to heal, because if it doesn't, you have problems. Now, the difference in a primary repair is, again, it's one-sided. You're getting your own native tissue to heal back. You're augmenting it with an internal brace to help support it to allow the ligament to heal. So that's what allows you to get back sooner. So you could pick up a ball in as little as 4 to 5 months after a repair, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 6 months when you do after a reconstruction. The problem is the time periods of getting back are slower when you do the reconstruction.
So, and does it differ by position, not necessarily for TJ, but for primary repair or internal bracing?
You know, from a throwing standpoint, obviously getting back into your throwing program, the necessities are different in a position player than a pitcher. So a position player can throw out to 120, 150, 180 feet, and that's really all they need to do. A pitcher needs to get out to the long toss and then start to throw off the mound, start to work on 15 to 20 pitch bullpens, then they advance to 30, 35 pitch bullpens, then they're doing an up-down, then they're facing live hitters, then they're facing live hitters again, and then they're throwing 1 to 2 innings in a game. And so the process is
much
just
longer.
Yeah. It is drawn out for sure.
Yeah, and I read somewhere, I think Jeff had said this, it's anywhere from 4 to 5 months for like first base, second base, whereas we're looking at like 7 months for pitchers, like you said, and even outfielders closer to like 6 months. But so I thought that was interesting, you know, the timeline different for different positions, but makes sense. And I think what's most important is, as practitioners, that our patients understand, clients understand what the expectations are, and we don't have to rush back if we don't have to, right? Especially for, you know, high school athletes or, you know, some of our younger clients and patients.
That yeah, makes sense? And timing of the season plays a role too, right? So, you know, I tell anybody who's getting back to a sport, doesn't matter what they're rehabbing, if you can afford to take the extra time, your season, a soccer player, when you're cleared by May or June, but you need to be ready by July, August. Well, take the July and August. Take that time period and let that be advantageous for you. Just because you're ready doesn't mean you have to push the envelope and allow it. Now, everybody wants to do that, and that's great. Now, if the season is kind of in front of you, sometimes you do have to be a little bit more aggressive with your timelines. But ultimately, the healing is the healing, and the performance is the performance. So if you're not ready, you're not prepared, I don't care if you're Bryce Harper or a high school athlete. You have to be ready to play, and you have to be comfortable with it. So you have to take the normal progressions. The other thing that people don't think about is sliding and diving after swinging a bat. What is it like to do that? Is it your lead arm? Is it your trail arm? Are you going to slide head first? Are you not going to slide head first? What do we want you to do? So these are all these things that come into play, and you have to do progressions no matter what you're doing. Hitting progressions, sliding, diving. People don't think about, okay, well, I'm going to dive for a ball. Well, the first time you dive for a ball shouldn't be in a game. You should have prepared. You start on your knees. Then you do low, you guys know this way better than I do when you're rehabbing athletes. You start with low velocity diving on your knees, start to work on higher velocity, standing, moving, all these things, and working your way into it. Typically, you know, obviously it's hard, you can't throw with a brace on, but if it's your non-dominant arm, wearing a brace to protect you from sliding are all things that are really valuable to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's an art. I mean, sliding is an art. I mean, you can see that with your own eyes, but even falling is an art. How to fall the right way and doing it on different surfaces, and maybe you're working on something a little bit more like slick that you can slide on more, and then working on, you know, working towards something a little bit like dirt, right, eventually. So
now, a question for Rob. Now, how do you do that in the therapy setting? Like, how do you get your athletes to kind of simulate game activity, things that you're going to be doing? Obviously, you have a little bit of turf out here. What are the things that you guys do?
I mean, from a training standpoint, like, I want to get them at game speed, doing things as fast as possible. So whether that's like sprinting, jumping, throwing med balls, doing sport-like activities as fast as possible so that we can try to replicate game-like environments as best as possible. Can I get someone to swing as hard as they can like they would in the box? Maybe, maybe not, but we can try to get them to throw a med ball as fast as they can. Yeah, that's kind of the tools that I like to use to, like, let's try to train the movement patterns that they're going to be doing in the sport, and let's try to replicate them in the gym.
No, that's a great answer. Now, when do you usually refer for, like, more power, right, or strength training? So I know for PT, usually it's within a few weeks, if not even sooner for internal bracing. But for strength conditioning, I've heard like 6-12 weeks. Well, 12 weeks for starting to throw. But like, is it like 6 to 8 weeks? Like more explosive movements?
Yeah, obviously we're trying to protect it and brace for about 4 to 6 weeks. So, you know, the goal in the acute window is get their motion back, make sure they're, you know, neurovascularly, they're doing well. As long as they can regain their motion, then typically around 6 weeks with an internal brace, you can start some light strengthening. By 8 weeks, we're starting to add a little bit of, you know, more gripping. You can start to progress into a little bit of light valgus loads. Probably closer to that 10 weeks, 12 weeks, you're starting to do some plyo work where you can start to see some valgus stress. You know, you want to start with obviously two-handed plyos followed by one-handed plyos. And then once they have achieved the one-handed plyos, then a ball gets in their hand. Yeah. But you can't cheat those things, right? You can't say, oh, I did two-handed plyos and I'm ready to throw. You will cheat yourself because you will not be ready to do it. And so that's the main thing, is you've got to follow the progressions.
And I think in terms of research on this, because it's such a newer procedure, at least with respect to internal bracing, I mean, you want accurate data, right? And this is probably a younger population that's got a clean ligament or, you know, a healthier ligament that you're able to do this with. And so they may be less likely to, you know, adhere and be compliant. So question for you, Rob, what do some of those you're getting TJ or primary bracing early or in their recovery? Obviously in PT, they're working range of motion, some different strengthening exercises. What kind of stuff are you focusing on with that athlete?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm seeing someone that has like a Tommy John surgery, like early on getting them to like exercise are things that I really want them to try to do so that they start to like feel like an athlete again, they're sweating again. And I think it's cool, especially in this setting where they can come in, they can rehab, and then they can work out right after or the next day. It's really convenient. It's in the same spot. The athlete feels comfortable, and just working the opposite arm, working the lower body, working some core, working some, you know, obviously like low intensity conditioning early on are things that I think are really important. And then as they progress and they're able to do strengthening stuff and with the physical therapist and they're able to do most strength stuff, I can start to do more strength stuff after that. PT will then coordinate with some of the plyometric activities. And then after they complete all the plyometric stuff and they're ready to kind of get the full go, that's where we'll start to really incorporate more traditional strength and conditioning training principles, where we're doing med ball work, dynamic landmine pressing in the upper body, you know, more aggressive lower body plyometric jumping, sprinting type activities to get them back on the field. Because once they're like complete that rehab process, now we have to kind of shift the focus to like more performance based stuff. And that's where we have to get the athlete like back to where they were or better. And I'm sure you guys get this all the time too, but it's like, oh, like, you know, I'm throwing harder after my elbow surgery. It's like, well, it's probably because you just actually did some good rehab and training for a good 6-7 months.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. The myth is I'm going to throw harder after Tommy John surgery. So this is the example you give, and it's pretty simple. If you're a 17-year-old and you injured your elbow and you were, let's say, for the sake of argument, you were throwing 85 miles an hour at the time you were 17. What is the likelihood, if you stayed healthy your 17-year-old year, 18-year-old year, 19-year-old year, that your velocity would increase? The answer is pretty high, right? So you might, by the end of that time, if you worked hard, 88, 90, 92. So if you spent 2 years rehabbing, as Rob mentioned, and you did all the work, you worked on your core, you built up your cuff strength, you worked on your scapula, you built up your forearm musculature, and you were 2 years older, you're likely going to be throwing harder than you were when you were 17, not because you had surgery, but because you are now 19 and more fit and stronger and more mature. So I think it's really important that this has nothing to do with the surgery this is not a bionic elbow. It's not a bionic implant. You're throwing harder because you've worked harder and you've matured, not related to surgery.
Yeah, it's good to put the misconceptions to rest because you hear that all the time. Yeah, crushed. Yeah. And that's something that, you know, in PT, like you said, the shirt's off, we're looking at the scapula, we're looking at the alignment, traps, et cetera. I remember we had Donnelly out of Widener when I was there, and that was awesome getting Phil out there. That was a long time ago, but learned a ton from him on how to analyze the shoulder and how to evaluate and assess, and then what to attack, what to address. And so the reality is we're identifying or addressing some of the impairments or deficits that led to this injury in the first place, right? So even further reinforcing your narrative on that. So I agree with you.
Yeah, and Phil Donnelly, he really was a pioneer in a lot of things. And if you haven't heard that name or you don't know him, he is likely responsible for a lot of the rehab that we currently do throughout Major League Baseball, not just locally. He was a real pioneer, and I learned a ton from him even in a short period of time as well.
Yeah, I'm at 3-hour lab at Widener. That's all I had with him. And I talk about him, I don't know, at least once a week. Yeah. I bring his name
up.
That's
great.
Yeah, God bless him. Still doing it. Let's talk a little bit about revisions. So from everything I'm seeing, reading about this, is that one of the benefits to a primary bracing procedure is that if that fails, God forbid it fails, then we can go the conventional TJ route. If you go TJ initially, then it's a lot tougher to do that revision, to my understanding. Can you break that down for me?
Yeah, sure. So if you have an internal brace and you fail, so you have a primary repair and you fail, and unfortunately I did one 12 days ago, so I'm back in the office today doing great and really happy so far. Obviously, it's still early. Then you go to a reconstruction. There's really, you don't have any options at that point. Now, if you do a reconstruction and it fails, there really are two options. And you would think, this doesn't really make a lot of sense, but your options are to actually do a repair of the reconstruction and augment with an internal brace. And you would say, well, why would you go the reverse route? Because what we know is that if you fail a reconstruction, 9 times out of 10, that failure happens actually at the humeral tunnel approximately. And oftentimes you have still fairly good tissue and you already have previous tunnels. You can actually augment, do a primary repair of that. And if you can get it to heal, and sometimes the flexor is involved with this. We actually had one of the Phillies minor league players had a reconstruction. He failed. He had good tissue. I recommended doing the repair. He did it elsewhere, and they did the same thing, and he's actually doing pretty well right now.
Great.
So, but your other options are to do, obviously, go take a reconstruction and revise it to a new one. The problem with that is, obviously, you have bone tunnels. You're working in a pretty small area. Lots of different technical ways to kind of navigate that. You can add an internal brace and do what's called a hybrid procedure at the same time. So there are a number of different ways. If you have really good tunnels, you can continue to use them. If you don't, you have to be prepared to do other tunnels. And you can actually go lower down, further up. There's a lot of different ways you can do what's called an onlay, which is you can repair the reconstruction on top of the bone, allow it to heal that way instead of putting it through tunnels. So a lot of different ways to do it.
A lot of different options, more often than not, to my understanding. If that was the best option, that's what they would have done initially, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of variables.
So the numbers, if you look at the ability to get back to pitch at an elite level is 55%. So 55% of major league, high level elite athletes, professional baseball players, get back to pitching after a revision UCL reconstruction. So would you be willing to give $700 million to somebody knowing that there's a 45% chance that he doesn't pitch for you? That's the big question.
Amen. That's an interesting number you picked there.
Good thing I'm not making that decision.
Right. it's fascinating because the research, right? Like we have some research, but obviously even with the primary repair, like we're still gathering more research, but it looks like the preliminary research looks promising. What are the percentages for TJ?
So the percentages for a primary repair are about 92%. The percentages for a true reconstruction are about 85 to 90%. Again, you may see them as low as 80, but generally about 85 to 90%. So they're relatively close. Obviously, the length of time is different, but the number after a revision reconstruction is 55%.
Right.
The number is quite a bit different.
Yeah, I'd be curious in terms of the location of the tear. I've heard that some docs will do mid-substance primary repairs. I know it's not like generally accepted. I know you're not doing them. It's got to be at one of the distal proximal attachment of that ligament. But what percentages of those surgeries that were done as primary repairs had a tear more like closer to mid-substance than to one of the ends? But
I mean, I can answer that. From a standpoint of those that are doing the research that are publishing data on this, they are not doing primary repairs on mid-substance tears. There would be no value in doing that. It's not going to be successful, and you have no chance of getting somebody back at a high level. You're probably looking at 30 to 40% if you do it in that setting.
How much of a role do you think the collagen plays?
Well, I think the collagen-coated tape, you know, certainly adds to it. The idea is that you're kind of putting it right on top of the ligament. And what you see if you go back in there is that that tape will be scarred down to the ligament. It will kind of incorporate to some degree into that. Obviously, you're not relying on a tape to be your ligament. So if you're relying on that tape, then that's not going to work either.
Right. Yeah, I saw that they do not allow for that, for the collagen component of the tape to be used in surgery in Europe. And so, therefore, we're doing it here. We're seeing different results. So, I'm just curious. I know Jeff had said that he thinks that's a big deal. So, what can be done to mitigate the risk of UCL injuries?
So, if you look at the risk factors, and Jim Andrews published a number of studies on UCL reconstruction. Well, what are the risk factors? Year-round throwing is a big one. Showcases, big one. Velocity, overuse. So, that's event overuse and seasonal overuse. You know, you see patients in the office and, you know, you have an athlete that comes in, they say they threw 130 pitches. It's disturbing to me. I've seen it on youth baseball fields. I've seen this volume of pitching out there. I've seen high school, college athletes come in. So that's a big one. The example I would give to an athlete who comes in and they say, well, I threw 130 pitches in a game. You know, if you look at, Gio Gonzalez, he won the Cy Young Award with the Nationals. Yep. The year after he won the Cy Young Award, do you know how many times he went over 100 pitches in the season?
How many times?
Twice. The entire season. So this is an elite level Cy Young Award winner.
Yep.
So
developmentally mature nonetheless, right?
So if that guy is not going over 100 pitches or, you know, on a routine basis, why would a high school athlete do that? And now there are some states that have pitch count rules. Some states it's 90, 95, 105. Some go up to 115. Some even go up to 125. So it varies state by state. But ultimately, if you're going to throw a high volume of pitches, there has to be a significant period of rest. The problem with, as you are well aware, you know, you get, you know, these weekend tournaments, these showcases, you know, athletes will throw 35, 40 pitches on a Friday. They may come back on Saturday. They may come back Sunday, or they may throw 60 pitches on Friday and then come back and throw another 50 on Sunday. We don't do this with professional athletes. Why would we do it with amateur athletes? So those are big risk factors. Velocity is a big one now. It's really a big one. And you can talk about weighted balls. You can talk about all these things, you know, plyo balls. There are advantages, right? If you're trying to gain velocity, go out and throw weighted balls. The problem is your arm is used to throwing a 5-ounce baseball. If you're throwing a 6-7 ounce baseball and you're trying to throw it as hard as you can, you may gain external rotation. You may gain that flexibility, but you're putting increased stress. So while weighted balls have a role and can be effective in some people at increasing velocity, it's a high-risk endeavor. So, you know, I can give you an example. I have I had a high school shortstop and came in, medial elbow pain. Dad said, you know, he finally got to the point where he's throwing over 90 miles an hour from shortstop. I said, that's great. He's here with medial elbow pain. Let me ask you a question. Why does he need to throw 90 miles an hour from shortstop? Well, but that's the numbers that people are looking for. Well, ultimately, I'm a little bit of an old school baseball person. Is if you play shortstop, can you get the guy out who hits you a ground ball? If you can get that guy out 9 out of 10 times, I don't care what your velocity is.
Right.
So ultimately, that's really the main thing. And so you're trying to gain velocity. Some people aren't meant to throw the ball 100 miles an hour. Some people are. Great for those that are. If you're trying, it's like some people aren't meant to run a marathon, right? We have all seen it. Somebody says, I'm training for a marathon. They're at 11 miles. Their body's breaking down. Okay. Your body's telling you something. Ultimately, when it comes to velocity, you want to do it in a natural way. There are ways to help that. But if you're doing it strictly by throwing weighted balls, you're going to put yourself at risk. And it really becomes a high risk.
Yeah. No, that's beautifully said. That's your world, Rob. So
It's like always walking a tightrope. Like, that's what I always try to explain to people. Like, strength and conditioning, we're trying to get you to move faster, get stronger, and throw the ball harder. Like, that's essentially what my job is. And it's always like a delicate road. Like, you have to manage essentially pushing performance and just, I'll describe health, like pushing health. We need to have a good balance of those two at all times. Or we're going to, if we just continue to drive performance, faster, faster, more weight. And we forget the like healthy stuff that we need to do. I'm just kind of bucketing that in there. Like, we're going to break down and we're going to have problems. And I think like it's the same approach with the weighted balls. Like, do they help with velocity? Yeah. Could they be problematic? Maybe. You know, you have to like risk reward here is like always the question you have to ask yourself. And like, as a high performer athlete, you have to try to walk the tightrope and make sure you're on the right side of it more often than not.
how much of this is education, right? Like, and there's no doubt in my mind, I'm sure, you know, we've had conversations with parents, each of us probably have, to educate. Like, ah, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. They go to somebody else, right? Like, they're going to find what they're looking for, right? You know, someone, if they're looking for a weighted med ball throwing program that is more extensive than any other one in the country, then they're going to find it eventually. Yeah. So do you have any advice for young healthcare professionals in particular, whether you're a surgeon or a PT or a strength conditioning coach, about how to go about navigating that process of educating both the athlete and the parent?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rob kind of mentioned it already. What are your goals, right? What are we trying to get you to be? What are you trying to do? What is realistic, right? Unfortunately, everybody who comes in, they're getting a scholarship, they're going to get drafted. We know that those numbers are not accurate. And so, you know, I think our goal is, you know, sometimes you have to say to the high school player, you haven't pitched. You'll have athletes who have had shoulder surgery, elbow surgery. They haven't played in 2 or 3 years. They're at a Division III baseball program. They want to play D1. My goal is, how about we play baseball, whether it's recreational or D3? And then if you're really good, you perform, then great. Then maybe you'll be good enough to do that. But the problem is that we put the goals in front of everything else. So we see the end, but we don't know how to get to the middle.
Love that.
And so, you know, that is really what, trying to figure out what their goals are. The most important thing, to be honest with you, is what are they doing on a day-to-day basis? How are they managing their strength and conditioning, right? I can't tell you how many pitchers come in and I say, what kind of program? What's your arm care program? Well, I do some J-bands before I go out and throw, and then I throw. If that's all you're trying to do, then the likelihood of success isn't going to be very good. You're in the office seeing me because you're having a problem. So if what you're doing currently isn't working for you, because it's not because you're in the office, then we've got to figure out a way to do the right things to get you there. Now, the easiest thing is to have them take their shirt off and turn around and face their parents and look at their scapula and have them move their arm and look at them. And 9 out of 10 parents say, oh my gosh, I've never seen that before. I never noticed that their shoulder blade is 5 inches below their other one. And until they get that, until they see that and demonstrate that, then they're not going to get it. So you have to demonstrate, what is the dysfunction here? What are they trying to get to? And how can you help them get there? Now, again, a catcher who throwing to bases in January when the season is starting in March or April doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, right? What are we trying to get to? You're trying to prepare for your season, right? A pitcher shouldn't be throwing live or off the mound in December. I get it, right? Just down the road here are a number of baseball facilities. I get it. So people take pitching lessons in December because that's when it's available. The problem is you don't need to be pitching in December. You need to be pitching in March. So if you're pitching in December and you're throwing December, January, February, March, you're already 4 months into your season and you're just starting your season, which is likely going to go through September or October. So you're basically throwing 10 months out of the year pitching. Again, we've got to use that. If you want to take pitching lessons, great, more power to you. I'm not the one receiving money. I don't have anything to do with it. Work on your mechanics. Work on the strengthening, being prepared to help you get ready to throw, not throwing off the mound in December, trying to throw 85 miles an hour when you don't need to do it for 4 more months.
It sounds pretty simple to me, but I guess that's not always how it's perceived, right? So beautifully said. Thank you for sharing all that. Rob, do you have any, you know, you want to add 2 cents to, you know, the different strategies that can be done to help with training? I know this is probably more of a George question, but a George Circle question. Any ideas or thoughts you have in terms of like modifying, like maybe throwing with a towel, right? Things like that you would recommend?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to like actually throwing and developing like the pitcher, I agree that like throwing early is not probably the way to go. You have to have like a slow build up and ramp up and slowly build up that workload. Like you mentioned earlier, like you broke down a lot of great steps that like pitchers have to go through to like get back into the game. And I feel like a lot of times that's definitely skipped. Or just like, oh, I'm just going to go from playing catch to just like maybe throwing off a mound. Like that's not probably the good approach that you should be taking. So I think a good recommendation is to just like have a good, well thought out throwing program that is getting you prepared to do the things that you want to do. So if your goals are to improve how the ball's moving or velocity or improve the way you're moving down the mound, maybe all three, have a good throwing program, just like you would have a good strength and conditioning program to help you get prepared for the season. So that was a very like general answer, but follow a good plan, have a good coach, find someone that understands that process and is coordinating with a good strength and conditioning coach, a good physical therapist, so that we can help prepare the person to, you know, perform on the field.
How young is too young to be working with strength and conditioning or doing some type of training Right? Do you have any take on that in terms of age? Because I'm sure there's, you know, parents or athletes listening at 12 or 13 or 11.
That's a good general age, like 12, 13, 14. Like whenever they're mentally mature to like follow instruction and like be in the gym, you know, like that's usually when I recommend they'd start some structured training. If they're younger than that, have fun, be a kid.
And I can't emphasize that enough. I feel like I say that anytime an athlete's got any kind of competition, they're leaving the clinic. Have fun. Make sure you have fun today. That's why we're doing this, right? So
you mentioned like the velocity part for like some of the younger athletes. Do you feel like we're seeing more elbow shoulder problems because if you had to pick one, like because they're throwing harder younger, or do you think it's more of like a overuse workload issue?
Well, I think it's more the training program, probably more than anything else, that's trying to get them to that velocity. But you know, you're in the facility. And the radar gun's there all the time. It's all the time. I mean, whether it's exit velo and hitting, right? My son turns around and looks at the
hit tracks
right away. Like you know when you hit a baseball good, right? So I'm not immune to any of this stuff in my own house, to be honest with you. My son, who's a catcher, you know, our goal last season as a 13-year-old was get your arm strong. Let's work on this. Well, you know, he's getting his arm strong. He's doing pretty well. But then he starts throwing off the mound for some reason because everybody else is doing it. And then it kind of took away from his arm strength because then his arm got a little bit sore because he's not a pitcher. So again, they're 13 and they don't know how to think right. But ultimately, that happens everywhere. And so our job is to try to educate him and say, okay, if you're a pitcher, that's fine. You shouldn't be just a pitcher at 13. That's a pretty difficult thing to do. But being prepared.
Be an athlete.
You know, the issue in Little League is your best athletes do pitch for you, right? And that is going to happen. Your best athletes are going to pitch more. That happens in Little League. So again, you got to manage that. You have to make sure your pitch counts are, you know, you're on top of that. But I think when it comes to the program and velocity, I think they're hand in hand, to be honest with you.
Yeah, beautifully said. And a little bit more here. I think it's important for parents I would encourage parents to ask the coaches questions, right? What are pitch counts usually abide by? How early is too early to be starting training? If he's playing, you know, if Johnny's playing on another team, you know, how do we communicate between the coaches? Or maybe it's me communicating with you about how many pitches he's thrown or what position he's playing. Because if they're playing catcher one game and then pitcher the next, you know, and they play a day pitch 2, 3, 4 days ago, 5 days ago, maybe that's a little bit concerning, right? Because they're going from catcher to pitcher to, you know, pitching again. So yeah, do you have any advice for parents on how to navigate some of this? Obviously, they want their child to have success and be happy, right? And you've gone through it firsthand.
You know? Yeah, so Little League obviously has rules. And the great thing about Little League baseball, and Cal Ripken's a little bit different. I can speak to the Little League side of it. If you throw more than 39 pitches in a baseball game, you cannot go back and catch. So can't do it.
Like
go over 39 pitches, you're not catching that game. If you catch more than 4 innings, you're not allowed to pitch. So these are rules that are put in effect for obvious reasons. Now, when it comes to, they play on multiple teams, the job of a coach, of a parent, is to look out for that athlete. And if the parent isn't looking out for the athlete, then I can tell you that the coach is not going to either. So if you have a child who pitches on multiple teams, you have to be responsible enough to say, this is when my child will be available to pitch for your team. Plain and simple. That's it. If they're not available to pitch, I'm going to tell you they're not available to pitch, and it's not a negotiation. They're just not. The best scenario, to be honest with you, is if they're going to pitch on just one team. That way you don't have to worry about it. That way they're not pitching on the other team. But if you're going to pitch on multiple teams, you have to know, okay, this is availability. These are when the last time I pitched. These are the pitches. And have that information in your pocket all the time.
Beautiful. Love it. I mean, copy that one and play that a few times. No, that's beautiful. Got anything else? Because I got a fast 5. All right. And you already took the first one. So that's good. So it's all good. All right. Let's run through it. So these are 4 quick questions. We'll do fast 4. All right. So one thing you've changed your mind about over the past year in regards to elbow pain or procedures regarding the UCL.
Well, that's a tough one. I got to give this in a couple word answer too. Boy, I would say that I mentioned a little bit earlier that just because they don't have pain doesn't mean they can't have a UCL issue.
I like that. Okay. What area do we need more research in with respect to baseball?
I think the idea of trying to get back, you know, everybody's trying to push the limit. You know, you will see some data that some athletes return at 10, 12 months, but you know, some people are talking about 16 months after reconstruction. What is the difference? That person that returned sooner, what was better about them and what took the other one so long? Is it a rehab issue? Is it a throwing issue? That's probably information that if we can get much more focused on, that might be helpful.
I love that. I don't know why we can't get that.
That's good. Yeah, we need that. I agree.
That's great. Yeah, what are the risk factors, et cetera, for a delayed return? All right, so the throwing a new return to throwing protocol just came out from Wilk and Reinhold. You know, they're with Andrews and Jeff and so forth. What is one component of a throwing protocols do we need to work on?
So the issue I have with throwing programs is they're not cookie cutter, right? So whether it's a professional athlete or a high school athlete, the question that I ask to them is, what is your normal long toss distance? Are you an ultra long tosser? Are you just somebody who throws a 90 feet and that's good enough for you? So if you're doing a throwing program and it asks you to get out to 180 feet, but you don't ever throw out to 180 feet, that's not part of what you do, that doesn't fit for you. So you have to know what their normal is before you can put them into a program that is going to help them.
Love that. Great answer. All right, last one. What is one thing you consistently tell Little League parents? I think we heard it already.
I've got to get off my soapbox. That's what I tell them. That's probably...
It's important for them to hear. I will say that, Doc. Like, it really is important for everyone, including kids, professionals, to hear this.
Yeah, I think it's ultimately certain people get hurt and it's fluky, right? It happens. People get hurt. People tear their ACLs. You know, Reese Hoskins is going back for a ground ball, kind of loses it in the sun, takes an awkward step. He tears his ACL. Those things happen. Right. But, you know, there are things that are preventable. And if we can do the right things for the athlete, we can lower the volume of injuries. And so, you know, again, a lot of the things that I'm saying are either from playing baseball myself, having kids that have played baseball, coached baseball, and taking care of baseball athletes for 17 years. And so the problem is that when you see somebody who's doing something wrong that is not setting them up for success, you need to intervene that in that situation. And if you don't, then you're doing them a disservice. And if I sit there and say, oh, you're doing great, and ignore that, then I'm really not doing my job. And sometimes it probably doesn't come off great. I'll be the first one to say it. But if we're not looking out for them, then who's going to? And so the problem is that there's a lack of education out there. And if we can just provide them with what makes sense. So sometimes somebody will say to me, I'll ask them to repeat, okay, how long did you take off from throwing? Okay, you told me, give me your dates. I'm going to say, okay, let me repeat this. So you took a week off of throwing. Oh yeah, that was a week off from throwing. Was a week enough? Probably not. Okay, when you went back to throwing, what was your volume of throwing? How long did you throw? Okay, if you're 16, you say, I don't know. I don't know. And mom and dad sit there and they go, I don't know either, because he doesn't tell me anything. But you're trying to get this information, not because you're trying to give them a hard time, but you're trying to help them figure out where did something go wrong, right? And if you threw out to 90 feet once and then you threw off the mound, you probably weren't ready. You didn't set yourself up for success. The problem is that when you come into the office, Rob comes into my office, he says, I have pain with throwing. What's my first thing I'm going to tell him to do? Stop throwing. Stop throwing. So you're in the office. You've come to me because you have a problem. You're having a problem throwing. We've got to figure out, can you continue to throw, or is most likely scenario you need to stop throwing and do rehab? So we've got to educate them. And if they're not doing the right things, we've got to help them get there.
I'll slide one more in there to make it five. How much time should throwers, pitchers in particular, take off from throwing?
So here's a rule of thumb that I use very frequently. The amount of time that it takes you that you stop throwing, let's say 3 weeks, say we shut you down for 3 weeks, it's going to take you another 3 weeks to build up to your throwing level to where you were when you stopped throwing. That doesn't mean you're ready to pitch. It means that you are back ready to throw, which means it's then going to take you another 3 weeks to throw off the mound to build yourself up. So a rest period of 3 weeks takes another 3 weeks to build up and then another 3 weeks to pitch. So you've rested for 3 weeks, you've thrown for 3 weeks, and now you'll pitch in 3 weeks. That's 9 weeks.
There you go. That's it.
So again, that number could be different. It could be 2 weeks. It could be 4 weeks. It could be 6 weeks. But whatever the time period is, then you have to then factor in, this is how long it's going to take me to build back up.
I think if Ronald published, if you throw more than 10 months out of the year, you're 10 times more likely to tear the UCL. So this has been amazing. You have anything else you want to throw in there?
That was all fantastic stuff. I think, like, really, if you're a baseball player or you treat or train baseball players, this is a must listen.
And PT, same thing. Sports medicine, anything sports medicine, I think this is highly relevant because it's more than, like you said, gymnasts. We talked about that at the very beginning. I mean, it's all a lot of different athletes can tear this ligament and will, you know, continue to put stress through the ligament. So what is the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you or to find you or learn more about you?
I'm not on social media. That's just not my thing.
Yeah.
Although I follow my daughter's college lacrosse team. So I'm on a hidden Instagram, just so that I can follow her on a game-by-game basis through Instagram. But, you know, I'm at the Rothman Institute. I see patients in media in Glen Mills, Northeast Philly. Go to our website, see a bio on me that you probably don't want to read. And then, you know, by all means, you can get in touch. But, I do have a clinical nurse and a clinical assistant. The direct number to our clinical assistant is 267-339-7812. That's my nurse. That's probably the most direct way.
Perfect. We will put everything in the show notes as well to get in touch with you. And I can say firsthand, I'm sure Rob would 110% agree that it's been a pleasure working with you and working with your patients. And it's been a fun ride. So that's a wrap.
Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. And the rehab is the biggest thing. We have, just to add, our physical therapist down with the Phillies. We have Alex Plum, who's up with the big league team now, and Justin Tallard, who's down there now. My patients, my surgeries, my professional athletes do really, really well. And it doesn't have anything to do with me. It has everything to do with the rehab.
Beautifully said. Yeah, I worked with Alex over the summer a little bit, or over the winter a little bit, and very impressed with him. Very impressed with him. So I completely agree. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. If you'd like this episode, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It would mean so much to me if you could leave us a 5-star review so more listeners like you could get this important information. See you next time.